Hello, everyone. I'm Megan Marie, Senior Community Manager at Crystal Dynamics. Welcome back to our monthly podcast, newly rebranded as the Crystal Compass. It's been a while since our last episode, so we're super excited to be back and bring new features, including news updates, in-depth interviews, and retrospective looks at Crystal Dynamics titles. This episode, we're diving into the mythological framework of Rise of the Tomb Raider with franchise director Noah Hughes. We know that you're all eager for any information you can get on the game, so this should be a fun one. We'll also answer fan questions with game director Brian Horton, enjoy a little musical interlude with Crystal Compass Radio, and go out on a classic Crystal retrospective, as we mentioned. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy. First, a bit of news in our quick hits segment. In early February, Rise of the Tomb Raider came back with a bang, debuting an exclusive cover story with Game Informer magazine. Coupled with online features, the coverage released next-gen screenshots, concept art, and addressed topics ranging from choosing mythology, which we'll get into a little bit more in this podcast, to gearing up Lara for inhospitable climates. Some of the other features included concept art galleries, exploring the new setting in Rise of the Tomb Raider, an interview with writer Rihanna Pratchett, discussing tombs and puzzles, film influences, and more. If you want to be completely up to date on all the Rise of the Tomb Raider information, definitely head over to gameinformer.com/ROTTR. Next news story. You might have heard the rumblings on social media, but we'd like to formally welcome two talented gentlemen to the Crystal Dynamics family, Tor Blystad and Nate Wells. Tor started his career at Funcom in Norway over 2 decades ago. After his time at Funcom, he moved to Denmark for a 10-year run at IO Interactive, contributing heavily to the Hitman franchise. So he's been in the Square Enix family for a while. Tor was most recently game and art director on Hitman Absolution, and he is now relocated to sunny California, joining us as a performance director. Nate Wells got his start in the industry at Looking Glass Studios, lending his talents to System Shock 2 and Thief: The Dark Project. Moving on to Irrational Games, he took up post as technical art director on Bioshock and art director on Bioshock Infinite. Fun fact, Nate is actually credited with the original concept and visualization of the Big Daddy. Nate is most recently known for his work at Naughty Dog as a lead artist on The Last of Us, and he's joining Crystal Dynamics as environmental art director. So a big welcome to both. We're super glad to have them on the team. In LC2 news, both of the Lara Croft and the Temple of Osiris DLC packs have dropped, including the Icy Death pack and the Twisted Gears pack. Fans in particular were pretty smitten with the Twisted Gears pack because it contained an awesome classic Croft skin. The LC2 community challenges are still going strong, and if you want to keep up with the weekly progress, head over to our official forums and check out the community challenge thread. Last but not least, we're bringing back features such as Croft Couture and continuing to regularly feature fan content on the Tomb Raider blog. If you want to submit something to be considered for a feature, please send an email to community@crystald.com. We'd love to see your work. And those are the big stories from this month. If you want to keep up with our daily happenings, head over to tombraider.tumblr.com. I am here with Noah now, our franchise director and creative director specifically on Rise of the Tomb Raider, and we get to talk about Rise of the Tomb Raider now. Isn't this exciting, Noah?
Woohoo, I can't
finally
wait.
So we just had the Game Informer cover, and one of the things they talked about was sort of the mythology behind the game, but now we have a little bit more time, and I think we can dig down a little deeper into it. So you ready for some questions?
Sure, we're still early, so we can only talk about so much, but...
The fans know, I mean, they don't want spoilers any more than you don't want to give them. So we'll skirt that line and just tease that stuff. But first off, does Rise of the Tomb Raider directly tie to what happened on Yamataya in the last game? And do you have to play the game in its entirety to understand and pick up Rise of the Tomb Raider?
Great question. We always set out to make a standalone story so that if you haven't played the previous game, you can come in and enjoy the current game a great deal. But we also strive to to pay off on sort of fans who follow Lara's adventures from one to the next. And so we strive for continuity, and we strive to create a story that people will get even more out of if they've played the previous one. So the answer is a little bit yes and no on this, which is I think absolutely it's a standalone story, but I encourage everyone to play the series and experience Lara's origin as well as her rise to becoming a Tomb Raider as a holistic story as well.
All right, well, let's get as specific then as we can at this time. What is the myth that we're exploring in Rise of the Tomb Raider?
We're talking about the lost city of Kitesh. This was an exciting myth for us. One of the things we started doing with the 2013 reboot was trying to find myths that were a little less explored in movies and media than some of the previous Tomb Raider myths. And that's always fun to sort of go through that process of cycling through all the possible myths that we could do. But there were a lot of things exciting about this one. But part of it was just this concept of a lost city that sunk beneath a lake. And as we talked about in the Game Informer article, we really wanted to give Lara this amazing first expedition to go on. And this idea that not only was there a secret lost to time, but there was also this fabulous place, this mythical place that you were going to travel to in order to find this secret.
Mm-hmm. Great. And so did you choose the setting of the game first and then find the myth, or did you have to select a myth and that kind of dictated the setting for the game?
It was a little of both, that we oftentimes do brainstorming about places in the world that would be cool to go and challenge Lara's skills in various ways, as well as just create new and interesting backdrops for the story. So we went through a lot of places that we could take her, but we also at the same time go through a lot of the myths, and part of what we evaluate in terms of a myth is where in the world does this take place and what culture is it a part of, and can we turn this one myth into you know, not just a part of the story, but really bring it to life in the context of the location and the architecture and the culture and the visuals, and as well as the stories and things like that. So when we found this one, we liked a lot of those facets. We liked the idea of a remote Siberian location, and that really played into our world fiction, that these secrets that are lost to time are buried in the most harsh and remote and hostile locations. Otherwise, they wouldn't still be hidden. So Siberia felt like a great place to hide a secret, and the mythical city of Kitesh sinking beneath the lake sounded like a great promise to discover.
So this mythology that we're looking at in Rise of the Tomb Raider, it encompasses multiple cultures. Can you talk to that a bit?
Yeah, one thing that's fun about the Kitesh myth is that not only does it have sort of the Russian backdrop to the mythology, but there's also, you know, legend has it that the city sunk beneath the lake when the Mongols attacked. And so there's this idea of a secret that was protected by some magical force that sunk this city into the lake. But the part of that story is these hordes of Mongols invading that city to steal its secrets. One of the things I love about it is it really backs up one of the core conceits. I talk about these secrets being hidden in these remote locations, and that's sort of a truism in the Tomb Raider universe. But the other truism that is that these secrets, that the power they represent really attract people like moths to a flame that would seek to possess that power. So the Mongols really tell the first version of that story as it relates to Kitesh and invading it for its secrets. But then we really see echoes of that through history, how it's not just the Mongols, but basically anyone who would seek to possess this, and that really becomes an important part of Lara's universe, is the desirability of these ancient artifacts and ancient secrets.
So in a similar way that Yamatai was this melting pot of cultures, because they literally got trapped there and had no escape. We're going to see a lot of like, see this as a cultural crossroads.
Yeah, it's fun. It allows us to layer in more cultures than just the initial Russian culture, and we love to have those layers of history and that, like you said, sort of melting pot of different identities that come to these places. So in this case, rather than the storm itself dashing people into the same survival situation, that we have the stories of this power attracting people through time to find it.
So you've mentioned this before, the mantra of sort of wanting a Googleable myth. So can you explain a little bit more what that means and what you're looking for with that myth?
Yeah, it's fun for us to ground the mythology in our real world mythology. It gives us a great inspiration. We always, as you know, take a certain amount of creative license and start to build upon the myth, and oftentimes reveal sort of our own sort of fictional truths behind the myth and things like that, which is great. But it helps a lot to start with that real world starting point, and I think that helps us because we can draw inspiration from a lot of these sort of real works of art and fiction and things like that. But also, I think for the audience, it's fun to be able to sort of look into, a little bit more maybe than it is even revealed in the story, a little bit more about the myths and the cultures that Lara is exploring.
So is there anything else that factors into making a good myth, making a myth a good fit in terms of, you know, the ability to Google it and kind of wrap your head around it easily, transcending cultures? Is there anything else you look for?
When we talk about transcending cultures, part of that is trying to ground the myth in a certain amount of credibility, that when we established sort of the post-reboot mythology, we really wanted to find things that you saw different versions of throughout the world, and, you know, from culture to culture, and you see echoes of these same stories, and it's easy to start to believe that these cultures independently come up with their own stories to explain unexplainable things or what have you, but there's also this possibility that they're all speaking to an underlying truth, that if you have the mythology of an immortal soul that transcends culture, and you really present that in a way that feels grounded and hopefully feels credible, that you can almost believe that somewhere in the dark corners of this planet there really are secrets that have been lost to time, that maybe at one point we knew something about ourselves or our condition or in this case sort of the nature of the human soul, and that secret has been lost to us, and we like to sort of believe that these commonalities of these myths might actually be truths.
So then, speaking to that mysticism, obviously Tomb Raider games are known for that, having that element of the fantastical. And as we would expect, Rise of the Tomb Raider is going to be no exception. But how do you work to balance it in a believable way that feels like it's maybe just that one step beyond reality, not taking the player too far?
I think a lot of that, I guess one of the things we strive to do is build up to it, that we, I think you would kind of use, very abstractly, Jaws as an analogy of something that's almost more powerful because you only glimpse it. And I think some of the myths we treat that same way. And we kind of talk about maybe a Raiders of the Lost Ark, and how it deals with mythology as something that you learn about through you know, through the culture, through the murals, through the books and ancient tomes and deciphering secrets and tombs and things like that. But you only just barely ever get a glimpse of it. And it is to some extent really earning that moment where you've built it up to a point where you could almost believe it could happen. And then you really get that final payoff. And we try to, you know, sort of build it a little bit more mysterious like that, and maintain some of the mystique of the myth. And I think, but again, that's always a challenge, that part of what's fun about playing with the mythology is making something fantastical, and that's inherently hard to believe. So it's a balancing act, which is, we like to make sure that we're not over constraining our imagination, and we want to make sure that when we pay off the myth, we really pay it off.
So this last question actually maybe more of a execution question, but how do you balance the exposition to the player who wants to, you know, you have players who just want to jump into the action and experience the core game, and then there are players who want to uncover every artifact and every relic and learn as much as they can about that mythology and put the puzzle pieces together. So how do you balance that to make sure that you're delivering the necessary bits to the people who are on that fast track?
Yeah, I mean, there's, I think one of the things that's great about a game and just interactive storytelling in general is the ability for lots of, you know, whether it's our documents or secondary missions or in-game storytelling and murals and images and things like that, that there's often a lot of canvas that you can use outside of the core cinematics. But as you point out, we always try to make sure that the basics of the myth and the story that's necessary to understand the overall plot is presented to the audience. So you'll often find a few scenes early on in a Tomb Raider game where people are talking about the myth as it exists before we start expanding and digging into the mysteries underlying it. So for those that played the reboot, remember probably the campfire scene with Sam, Sam and Matthias and the orange.
And the orange. I was wondering if you're going to bring that up.
And that was an example of one of those story time scenes, as I like to call them. Yeah. So you can expect to have some other scenes where characters are chatting about the mythology.
Well, that's it for now. Thank you so much, Noah. It's been great chatting with you again. We'll have to have you back next month. And I guess we can open it up to the community, to listeners. What do you guys want us to touch on next?
Yeah, I'm very excited. Like you said, it's nice to be able to talk about stuff again. So thanks for sharing, and I hope we answered some questions, but I can't wait to come back.
So now I am joined by Brian Horton, who is our game director, which is exciting. This is new from last time, so congratulations.
Oh, thanks, Megan.
So we have some fan questions. Some of these are quite broad, but we'll see how much we can answer early on. We have our monthly Q&A, and these were a couple that hadn't been answered because we limited to 5 questions for those monthly Q&A sessions. So our first is, Teskar70 asks, to what extent has the work on Tomb Raider 2013 been built upon during the development of Rise of the Tomb Raider, and can you share any examples? So I think they want to know about the evolution from the last game in terms of the foundation we started with.
Yeah, that's a great question, because when we were going about making the last Tomb Raider game, it was explicitly our goal to really look at the franchise freshly, everything from the ground up, like really rebuild the game. Mm-hmm. For Rise, we wanted to build on the foundation that we established on Tomb Raider 2013. So what we did was take a lot of the things that we liked and use that as a foundation, especially as we were doing early prototypes. You know, everything was pretty much the same foundation of the game. From there, though, we started thinking about what are the things we could grow and build on. And that's where we started getting into really thinking about survivalist systems, to think about the living world and how to make hubs more engaging, build that survival sandbox, and to really double down on some things we introduced in our Desperate Combat in the last game. Now that Lara is more confident and aware of her surroundings, we're starting to introduce more mechanics around how she can have this guerrilla style in her combat. So a lot of what we were trying to do was build on the foundation of 2013 and bring something new. So as her as a character has evolved, so have the abilities.
Okay, our next question is from Ray, and she asks, will the hubs be better utilized within the story path, allowing for a slower pace rather than the go-go-go urgency of before?
We always give the player an option to explore hubs. We introduce them in places where it's a natural place to take a break and really exploit them. But there are those players out there that really want to continue along the main storyline, and we don't prevent the player from doing that. So it's always one of those things where we want to give the player a feeling that they can take a break from the main story and really explore and find some challenge tombs or do some hunting, pick up some collectibles. I think we've allowed for a pacing that keeps the story motivated, but gives you those opportunities to use the hubs.
All right, our third question is from Teskar again, who says, how difficult is it to acknowledge and or reflect on the legacy of Tomb Raider while at the same time following your vision for the reboot?
We're always respectful of the past. We always reflect on what came before us. As we've said in past interviews, this is a reimagining of Tomb Raider and Lara Croft as a character. So she will never quite evolve into the classic core vision of what Lara was. But we always try to make sure she's maintaining the spirit, and the franchise maintains the spirit of what it's always been through our modern lens. So what we tried to do is think about how would Lara evolve from where she was on the last experience that she did, and what challenges do we want to present her with that would make her continue to embrace her legacy. I mean, this is Rise of the Tomb Raider. It is a continuing journey on her finding her destiny. So,
okay, another question from the community, and this is one that we get kind of frequently. Is archaeology still at the heart of Lara's experience with tomb raiding? She tends to leave a little bit of damage behind her sometimes.
The idea of being a tomb raider isn't purely an archaeologist. Mm-hmm. She has the soul of an archaeologist. She has the desire to find these ancient relics and societies and the mysteries of the world. But often she's presented these life and death situations. And if when you're in a situation like that, she's going to take a route that's going to allow her to survive. And oftentimes that does leave a bit of damage on the back end of it. She's not there to do anything other than hopefully, seek out the truth. And in doing so, she's putting her life on the line. And she does have a reverence for ancient cultures and societies and artifacts and relics. And obviously, we exploit that in the relic system too. There's a lot of reverence for the things she finds. But at the same time, it is a survival action game, and in doing so, there is going to be a little bit of collateral damage.
All right, our next question. It looks like it's both from Blacktron and Chocolate Shake. That's a fun name. Says that Daryl called Rise of the Tomb Raider something truly special and the most ambitious Tomb Raider ever built. And they want to know in what way. Can you tell us anything about what's so ambitious in the game? Is it the length, graphics, new gameplay features that no TR game has had before? Or what do you see as those cutting edge features?
We've had a fantastic opportunity on the sequel to utilize the generation switch mm-hmm. to bring another level of fidelity and performance into Lara and the supporting cast members. So that's a huge thing for us, is to be able to continue make Lara the most believable character in video games. And the other thing is the scope and breadth of the game. We've often talked about our hubs being large in the last game, but we've really tried to make sure the size is larger, and we've talked about three times the size. Not only is it larger, but it's more dense. So we've put a lot more work into the systems of the game to not only make larger hubs, but to make these hubs even more immersive and interactive. So every single system in our pillar, every aspect of the game, we've built on the last. So yeah, it would definitely say it's the most ambitious game we've made.
Fantastic. I think the hub size in particular is going to get fans excited. All right, and one of the GI features, you said it's not easy being a Tomb Raider. What are the challenges that we're going to see Lara encounter, and how will she rise to the occasion? They made their pun there. We're getting a lot of rise puns.
I'm not going to go into a lot of details because I don't want to spoil the surprises, right?
Yes.
But I can tell you that stakes are always an important part of being a Tomb Raider. The idea that Lara is going after some of these secret truths in the most distant and hostile places in the world means that she has to up her game. And we've seen in the Game Informer article, she's coming prepared. You know, she's not going in there unaware of the danger that she's going to face. But even being prepared, there's things that she will discover and encounter that she'll have to learn to take on and overcome. So trying not to be specific because I don't want to give spoilers, but just know that the challenges we present Lara and the player are building on the same patterns of you introduced to something, it's extremely overwhelming, you learn, you grow, evolve, and eventually hopefully master.
So one last question, and this one has been popping up since the really awesome international press cover that we've shown of Lara in the ice cave. So what's your process for doing renders in terms of, they know that you do a blend of photography and art. So what's that process like?
Sure. So I was very fortunate to be able to learn some photography in the past few years. I've always been a painter. But my fine art has brought me to photography. So I studied photography and I've been doing it now for about 6 years. And when we did the cover for Tomb Raider 2013, we worked with an amazing agency and they did this great photo shoot and I was along for the ride. And I was like, wow, this is a great way to get some really high resolution promotional images. So the goal is always, what is the image? What's the content that we're trying to create? And Bren is really the guy who drives what that content is. We'll have discussions about it, but he tends to come up with the images and iconography. And then once we agree on that iconography through concept, then we bring a model in, we do wardrobe, makeup if needed, and we start to do pose explorations. And I set up my lights, my studio lights, which I generally have two of those, and I have a Canon 60D, and I try to get the highest resolution images I can to either for me or for Bren to render images into from the model that Cam Yu created. So we're using all of our game assets this time, blended with photography to create some of those cover images you've seen on Game Informer or the one that we did for our international press.
Very cool. So would you say the final piece, is it a 50-50 blend? Is it more lean towards one side of the photography and the art and the paintovers and so on?
I think the last couple that we've done have been more photography influenced, and then we've brought in render stuff for likeness and things like that. The technique is both illustrative and photographic. We're just trying to get a movie poster quality is okay. Really what we're going for, and that's sort of the inspiration behind the current aesthetic for PR images.
Fantastic. Okay, well, that's what we got for this time, so we'll make sure to bring you back on next month and answer some more fan questions. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks, Megan, and thanks, everyone.
And now for something a little different with Crystal Compass Radio. We're going to take a quick break before the final segment of our podcast and let you listen to two tracks, one classic and one current, from our titles. This episode, we're going to listen to the main theme from Tomb Raider: The Last Revelation, composed by Peter Conley, followed by the Lara Croft Overture, composed by Wilbert Rodgett, for Lara Croft and the Temple of Osiris. These two tracks have been specially chosen to lead into our classic Crystal feature, which takes a retrospective look at Tomb Raider and the allure of ancient Egypt. Enjoy!
The inscription reads, "One night, in dreaming, came to me the spirit of the Sphinx. In his passing, he spoke unto me words of great wisdom. Tutmosis, here is your true destiny. This land of Egypt is forever yours to rule."
Lara Croft is a well-seasoned adventurer. Her exploits have taken her around the world and back again, traveling from the darkest corners of Parisian streets to the dense jungles of India and even the frigid and isolated landscapes of Antarctica. She's also pinpointed the fabled city of Atlantis. No big deal there. Despite all of this globetrotting, many fans agree that the quintessential archaeological expedition is one that sees Lara braving the sun and sand of Egypt, which she's done in the original Tomb Raider, Tomb Raider: The Last Revelation, the mobile title Tomb Raider: The Osiris Codex, and most recently in Lara Croft and the Temple of Osiris. This isn't even counting her trips to the Land of the Nile in the comics and other offshoots. There was that messy business with the cat goddess Bast in the Top Cow series. Lara isn't alone in these adventures. Fictional explorers like Indiana Jones found himself drawn to Egypt in his quest for the Ark of the Covenant, as did Rick and Evelyn in their altruistic attempt to undo the mess they made in The Mummy. But these fictional tales aren't to be outdone by real-world accounts, such as with Howard Carter, who discovered the tomb of Tutankhamun and was thought to have suffered the curse of the pharaoh as a result. Then there's the 19th century explorer and novelist, Amelia Edwards, whose travels throughout Egypt led her to compile her hand-drawn illustrations and travelogue into the 1887 bestseller, A Thousand Miles Up the Nile. These discoveries acted as a catalyst for periods of increased interest in Egyptian culture by the Western world, referred to as Egyptomania in a broad sense. Their influence can be seen to this day, from the obelisk in Washington, D.C., to the Egyptian bridge in St. Petersburg. The world is full of intrigue and adventure, so what makes Egypt stand out as an oasis for fantasy and fiction? The History Channel states it well. Egypt is a culture so rich that it spawned its own field of study. Noted as one of the cradles of civilization and as having one of the longest histories of any modern country, Egypt offers incredible breadth and depth to draw from. In particular, Egypt has an incredibly well-preserved legacy of art and the written word. Hieroglyphs and their less formal variations of script allow us to read and comprehend much about daily life in ancient Egypt, as well as the more fantastical tales told in religious texts. There is little need to exercise your imagination with these tales. They are so colorful and rich, they beg to be told time and time again. The discovery of the Rosetta Stone, inscribed with ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs, Demotic script, referred to as document writing by Egyptians, and ancient Greek, provided a key to the modern understanding of Egyptian hieroglyphics, and as such, opened Egyptian culture to the rest of the world. And there was an incredible amount to draw from: religious materials, funerary texts, hymns and rituals, temple decorations, and more. Who could forget about the Book of the Dead, fragments of a funerary text with nearly 200 spells aimed at helping one navigate the afterlife? The stories these murals and texts told were ripe for adventure. These gods make for perfect antagonists, or allies. They are literal personifications of good and evil, of life and death, of chaos and order. The lines are already drawn. The Osiris myth, one of the most elaborate and fleshed out ancient Egyptian myths, is explored in our recent Lara Croft and the Temple of Osiris. Some creative liberties are taken, but the heart of the myth remains true. Alicia Thayer, designer on Lara Croft and the Temple of Osiris, was part of the team that decided to explore the Osiris myth in LC2. They used concept explorations from the Guardian of Light team as a starting point for their brainstorm.
We had a few settings we were tossing around as options, but Egypt definitely generated the most enthusiasm from our team, and so we spent some time familiarizing ourselves with Egyptian mythology and some of the key players in Egyptian myth. The Osiris Myth was a fun choice for us because it adapted so easily to simple, arcadey video game structure. Osiris was murdered by Set and split into a varying number of pieces depending on the story, which gave us a fun, thematic, kind of Triforce-y, kind of collectible to frame our levels and progression.
Once the LC2 team decided that they did in fact want to move forward with the Osiris Myth, they say the rest of the characters fell into place pretty easily. Isis reassembled the pieces of Osiris in order to conceive their son Horus, making them both viable options for playable characters.
As for other gods, we had a handful of meetings early on where we discuss our favorite characters and themes. Like, for example, Ra was brought up a great deal in the beginning because we were touring with a lot of light-dark ideas, and he's a solar deity. But he also had this really great boat that he traveled on that took him through the sky and into the underworld. And we loved the idea of a level on, like, a magical solar boat. And, like, for example, Ra and Set showed up in our early meetings because they fought Apep together. And we loved the idea of fighting, like, a big snake boss. And if you played the game, you'll notice that we ended up keeping Apep as a boss.
Set was a familiar face to fans, being first introduced to the franchise after Lara accidentally unleashed him on the world in Tomb Raider: The Last Revelation. Fun side note, according to Alicia, for a split second the team considered tying LC2 to The Last Revelation, featuring Lara trapped in the underworld and trying to fight her way out, but they decided to keep it a spiritual successor rather than a chronological one. Playing by the rules of ancient Egypt also means that death isn't final. It's the start of a new adventure, full of further trials and tribulations. If the dead can make their way through gateways with spirits and other monstrosities, their heart will be weighed against a feather by the god Anubis. If the heart is found heavy and rejected, it will be eaten by Ammit, the devourer of souls, and the individual will never reach paradise. As Alicia hinted at, using Egypt as a location means that boss battles nearly write themselves. Ammit is a female demon, part lion, hippo, and crocodile. Here's a few more. Apep, who Alicia also mentioned, is a giant serpent and enemy of Ra, also known as the Lord of Chaos, and the embodiment of all that's evil. He's known for being miles long and so large that he attempted to swallow the sun every day. He was at the center of a really fun puzzle-esque battle in LC2. Another god turned boss, Khepri. Khepri is a scarab god and solar deity, thought to roll the sun through the sky in the same vein that a scarab beetle rolls dung. Guess how that one played out in the game.
So one of our designers, Jeff Wages, had always really wanted to do a boss fight on like a rolling ball, and so he adapted that idea to the Khepri myth. So we wrote up a brief and he tossed it my way, and we used that to prototype Khepri as our first spectacular boss. So narratively, Khepri was a nice place to start because his myth ties into themes that you see repeated over and over again in Egyptian mythology and iconography. The sun, scarabs, rebirth, life and death, light and dark, all of which we were using to inform our game mechanics early on.
So as you can see, these myths are grandiose, full of conflicts at play to the duality of human nature, and ripe in intrigue. They're a pretty great fit for pop culture and for a game. The ancient Egyptian achievements in the physical realm are pretty incredible too. Egypt is home to monuments that have stood the test of time, be it pyramids, crypts, or sphinxes. Who wouldn't want to explore the Valley of the Kings or the necropolis in Thebes, inspired by name alone? The best part? The origins of some of the world's oldest and largest monuments, such as the Great Sphinx of Giza, is still hotly debated. When was it built? By whom and for what purpose? The concept behind the Riddle of the Sphinx is actually based on this enigmatic nature, again, lending an air of intrigue to ancient Egypt. To this day, new discoveries are still being made. Expeditions continue year after year. According to National Geographic, before 1922, it was widely believed that 62 tombs in the Valley of the Kings were all that existed. Then, Howard Carter discovered the tomb of Tutankhamun. In 2005, another tomb was discovered, only 50 feet from the walls of King Tut's final resting place. In January of this year, an ancient replica of the mythical tomb of Osiris was unearthed. Who knows what else is out there to find? Staring out into the dry and desolate landscape of the Sahara Desert, you can't help but feel that there are secrets just waiting to be discovered. Time and sand reclaims all. Until an adventurer like Lara Croft comes to find them, that is. And that's it for this episode of the Crystal Compass podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show and the new features we've added to it. Feel free to send your feedback to community@crystald.com. Until next time.